Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another event at the, well, not at the Poison Pan, clearly, because I'm on my library, but nonetheless, another Poison Pan event. I'm Barbara Peters. I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona, and Heather is somewhere in California, my guess is.
Yes, Santa Rosa, north of San Francisco.
So I'm going to overcome my rooted objection as a Stanford graduate to acclaim the work of somebody who went to Berkeley. You have to be there to understand what that's all about. But I don't know if the rivalry is still as intense now as it was, you know, way back when, is it?
You know, I'm not a regular attender of games or anything, but when my son was looking at colleges, it very much was still, and that wasn't very long ago. So yes, it probably is.
Probably is, right. So, you know, there are college, storied college rivalries everywhere, but Stanford versus Berkeley is a big one. But anyway, and I mentioned the college because there's a college background in this story, which is called Before She Finds Me. Great cover, by the way. So it's not really a dark academic mystery in the sense that, you know, it's the life of the college that, at least I don't classify it as one where that's the case. Much of the action is by people who aren't actually enrolled at the college. But Julia, one of the main characters, is a professor there. And I was interested to see, Heather, in your note, you said that you actually know zip about botany, but you took a shot at making her a botany professor. So that was pretty brave of you. You know, if you're a person who kills plants, including the fake fiddle leaf in your living room, as you point out, why'd you decide to give her botany as an expertise?
It was part of the story as I envisioned it. And I was like, oh no, that means I have to go figure this out, because I was not exaggerating. My friend gave me this ficus she'd had for 20 years and said, oh, there's no one who can kill this. It was dead within a month. It's just, I'm just not good with plants. So, but it just, you know, I knew Wren was someone who liked to poison people and was a little bit obsessed with poison flowers and plants. And so it made sense for Julia. I had always envisioned her to be on the campus. I just didn't know in what capacity. And then so when I decided with my editors, like, hey, why don't we do that? I was like, okay, let's see what botany professors I can talk to. And luckily people are always so generous with their knowledge when you reach out about, you know, something they're so knowledgeable and passionate about. So, you know, that was the path. It was through research. So I know more about flowers now, you know, and
good for you. Right. I mean, you can now buy cut flowers at the Safeway. You know, you don't even have to go to a florist. There used to be much more of a flower culture. Phoenix, for example, had these beautiful Japanese gardens that were famous, but eventually development, you know, paved right over them on the way to another round of apartment buildings. So I understand it. This is a total digression, but I'll mention it anyway. So I understand it. Hokkaido, which is the northernmost isle of Japan, is now one of the major sources for cut flowers.
Oh, I did not know that. We learn something new, don't we?
Right. You can incorporate it into another book should you want to do that. So you've actually written two earlier books, one, No Bad Deed and Blood Will Tell. So you're a fan of standalone rather than series kinds of stories, is that right?
That is. I've always been drawn to stories that have a family at its core that's being tested in an unusual way. And because of that, it's kind of would be very challenging to say, okay, you know how you had this murder? Now you have another murder, you know? So yeah, it very much lends itself to more of a standalone, though there are some characters like the character of Wren that I was like, I would have loved to explore her in different ways, because she could. She is a different type of character in that she can be involved in murder a lot because she's an assassin. But you know, the usual suburban mom moving her daughter into college, less so. She's not going to have too many murders on her doorstep, hopefully.
Well, I think, you know, a distinction. I had a really interesting conversation with Riley Sager about this Monday night when we launched his new book, because he actually wrote three or maybe four books in a series before he adopted a new name and started over writing standalones. And he really likes that because, for one thing, it's hard. I've talked to other authors about this too. If you put people through the kind of ringer that you put them through, it's really hard to go back and torture them again. You know, I mean, they sort of deserve to, if they survive. And that's another thing, is that not everyone in a book like this is guaranteed to survive, as opposed to in a series where at least one character, the series lead, is always going to survive. It puts everybody in jeopardy, but it's also more realistic to think this is the worst thing that will ever happen to these people. And either they'll make it through or they won't. And if they make it through, then the reader gets to imagine, you know, what kind of life they might lead. So you have two women in this story who, they're other characters, but to a great degree, they're the two poles in this story. One's called Julia and one's called Wren. So why don't you tell us about them and maybe how you arrived at the two of them?
Well, it was my first truly dual point of view novel. And I arrived at the character of Julia first because she came to be when I was, you know, moving my own daughter into the college dorms. And I was thinking, what's the worst that could happen? Let's make that happen. And so I always had her as the character. I knew she was going to be a single mom and that she was going to be, have this very deep connection with Cora that makes her a little bit, you know, protective of, I mean, every, you know, parent is protective, but, you know, she has seen some pretty bad things and she knows what's out there and she's spent her whole life trying to protect Cora. And then the worst does happen. And I always knew I wanted to start in that way, but I didn't really know where I wanted to go from there. And then I was interviewing a colleague who happened to be very pregnant and also had a husband who cloned carnivorous plants. And so all of a sudden, yeah, it was very fortuitous. She's a very nice person, nothing like Wren, but I all of a sudden had this idea of like, that's the foil, that's, it's going to be dual point of view, it's going to be a cat and mouse thriller. And so I needed to have two equally weighted, equally, you know, determined women at its core. And I wanted them very much on parallel tracks to, you know, intersect and, you know, great chaos and conflict. So I always knew I wanted to have these two women characters at the core of the story. And that's kind of how it evolved. And I knew that Wren would be somewhat, her social circles, because she's a pregnant assassin who, you know, doesn't have a lot of friends. She deals with people that are pretty bad people. And so she's never really had a friend. And so Julia represents everything she hasn't had. So I wanted there to be this certain fascination. And I had to figure out what would make someone like Wren, who sees the bad in so many people, see Julia and how they could be at odds with one another. So they are a lot alike, but they're also very, very different.
So Julia is a college professor. Her husband, Eric, has divorced her and has remarried to a woman named Bree, who's actually kind of a third pole in this book. Although in the opening scene, any spoiler to describe the opening scene, which we'll do in a minute. So Bree is not really with us throughout the novel, at least alive. And Julia has a daughter called Cora, who is enrolling in college. So it's one of those, you know, awful post-divorce moments when you take your daughter to college and your ex-husband shows up with his, you know, new wife. And it's one of those awkward moments that nobody really knows how to get through very well, especially if the new wife is, bitchy or at least difficult. And you don't want to make a scene and embarrass the child who's, you know, got two parents there and doesn't really want to be in that fight. So that's one. Now tell us a little more about Wren, because Wren is not a single actor in this drama.
Yeah, Ren is a newly pregnant assassin who was raised into the trade by her father, who was a single father who had some issues around trust and some life circumstances that kind of led him to choose this career. And Ren is, you know, he's trained her with this mantra about, you know, kill the innocent. I mean, excuse me, not kill the innocent, kill the guilty,
right,
protect the innocent, and defend the family. And so she's been brought up with this mantra her whole life. And, you know, then she met and married a man in the trade as well. And so she has a very limited worldview. On the one hand, she is a very, you know, strong woman, and at the on the other, she's kind of also a little bit naive, because she is a, you know, somewhat awkward socially, and she doesn't have a lot of experience in that realm. So she has definitely a very complicated history, and that is actually part of what draws her to Julia, is that Julia also has a complicated relationship and backstory with her parents. And so it's another way that they're kind of on the same mirrors of each other, but at the same time, very, very different. So, you know, if they'd been different people, maybe they would have been friends. But, you know, they're on the opposite sides of this fight. So, yeah, so that was Ren. She, and again, is obsessed with poisonous plants. And when she learns that Julia is a botany professor and also clones carnivorous plants in her free time, she, you know, becomes even more fascinated with her.
But what is the incident that gets them? I mean, because in normal circumstances, they never would have met. So what is it that happens at the outset of your novel? We can at least talk about that.
That sets up
this... you know, duality, and also the cat and mouse game that ensues.
Ren is married to the hired killer who was on campus that day. And she and him, Nolan is his name. She and Nolan plan, you know, she plans the jobs, he executes them. Sometimes she'll execute them too, but they always work in tandem, and they always work according to this very meticulous planning that she does. She makes her kill maps, and, you know, she has a certain way of doing things, and he's always, you know, done the same. He's always respected her role in their partnership. And so this is unusual in that she didn't know about this one. He didn't tell her about this one. And so that kind of, Julia wants to know, hey, why did this horrible thing happen that put my daughter in grave danger? And Ren is wondering, why did my husband do this terrible thing without checking with me first? So
it appears that there's just a shooter on campus, and it's tragically every day there's another, you know, random shooter somewhere, anywhere. I mean, there's really nowhere safe at this point. You could be in the gas station or at the 7-Eleven or, you know, in a doctor's office, and now there's just people with guns and hair trigger tempers. It's amazing. I don't think I've opened the Arizona Republic in the last year where there hasn't been at least one shooting. Most of them, you know, not clever, meticulous assassinations or anything, but just people who have a gun and, you know, lose control or whatever it is. I mean, it's just, if the idea of all this gun thing is to keep us safe, it's actually working entirely in the opposite. But so anyway, here's Julia. It's enrollment day or whatever it is, or welcome to campus day. And, you know, a shot rings out, and she recognizes what's happening more quickly than anybody else. So she falls upon Cora to protect her. But other people aren't so lucky.
Yeah, you know, of course, when I was, that germ of the idea was very much driven by the worst that I could imagine happening in that moment. And you're absolutely right. I mean, my daughter's school was locked down because of it ended up being a replica BB gun on campus on graduation day. I mean, you can't escape it these days, you know. Right. Either it's the most terrifying thing I can think of as a parent. I remember getting the text on graduation day, you know, I'm okay. And I'm like, why wouldn't you be? Please, yeah. You know, tell me. And so those are the kind of texts you don't want to get from your children. But I mean, not getting them, I, you know, and I think that was part of my process with this. And I know I'm getting way off track, was to work through this complicated, you know, issue we have in our country. And it was a way of me, you know, writing's always been cathartic for me. And so it was a way coming to terms with my own thoughts and feelings about it. So, I mean, yeah, there's that. And I'm sure I just totally blew past whatever question it was you asked.
You did fine. I mean, you know, it's an interesting scene. And, you know, when you read it, you go right past a couple of clues that Heather very kindly puts in. I was impelled to go back and read the opening scene at some point during the book in order to, when I appreciated it. We're certainly not going to tell you what those things are, so, because you'll have the same experience. So, you know, did it spring fully to your mind, or did you have to put some real effort into setting up that whole first chapter?
I think a lot of authors spend a lot of time on that first chapter. I try not to get so mired in it that it doesn't allow me to continue to explore the story. By explore, I'm totally an outliner, but still it surprises me sometimes. And it is, you know, through that process of discovery, I'm like, oh, I need to go plant more clues. Right. So I would say it was, as far as intent and structure in that first scene, it probably was 65% fully formed. And then it started to be layering. The way things happened was always going to go that way. That wasn't a surprise. But as I kind of honed in on what I wanted to say and how I wanted it to end and the midpoint and all those mileposts along the way, it did kind of surprise me a little bit, because I envisioned the first scene and the climax almost simultaneously, which almost never happens. You know, it was like I could see them as if they were a movie in my head. And then I'm like, how do I get from there to here? Was the surprising part. So I did go back and I make sure that it was supported, because I mean, ultimately we want to surprise readers, but we want them also to be satisfied. We don't want them to say, I didn't get that, because that's totally doesn't, you know, that's a, that wasn't supported. You know, I don't even hate it if someone says, hey, I figured it out, because that means the clues are there. But I mean, I think it would be far worse to have a reader say, where did this come from? It doesn't make any sense. I think that would be a far worse thing than I figured it out, you know, because thriller readers are smart. You know, some of them will figure it out, and that's okay, you know.
No, it is okay. And of course, you don't know what to look for. So, you know, that helps with the misdirection. It's only later that you recognize that, you know, there was something there that you could have seen, but at the time didn't appear to be important. So you always knew how, I was going to ask you that, you know, you always knew how it would come out. I thought you might have debated some about, sadly, we can't talk to you about this, but I thought you might have debated some about the final outcome.
Well, there are several things. I mean, the climax is pretty rich with stuff.
Yeah. Well, the final but one. Anyway, as we mentioned, you know, it's an interesting question in a book like this about who survives. So, you know, since everyone could actually be killed, then I think making choices about that. The reader should not be able to expect, you know, who's going to live and who's going to die. in a book like this. So, you know, sometimes in a cat and mouse game, both the cat and the mouse die. You know, it's not necessarily true that one will win.
Yeah, and I think you are correct in saying there were things that I knew were going to happen, big moments in the finale that I knew were going to happen, but I also want to be a little bit surprised by how the final conflict ends, because if it's too like paint by numbers, then it won't be fun for readers. It won't be fun for me to write. I want to kind of explore it, and like, I want there to be real, you know, tension over who is going to survive this. And I think if I know, then, you know, I know in draft two, in draft one, I don't always know.
Oh, so do you, I see you had quite a large writer circle because you mentioned a whole bunch of names in the back. Was this a book that, you know, you shared with others as you went along, or how do you work with other authors when you're involved in a circle?
You know, I wrote my first book totally in a bubble. I wrote it. No one read it. I had a friend read it, the first draft, and then I tore it up and changed it from three points of view, third person, to a single point of view. And no, the first person to read that book was my agent. No one read it before then. And so it was about finding my voice and learning. You know, I'd written practice books, but it was where I really kind of felt excited. And books two and three, I kind of built my community, and I no longer had to be in a bubble. And so that's the thing that's so, so great. And also I was part of a debut group, the 2020 debuts. Mm-hmm. And we were forged in fire. I mean, you know, and so I think that really helped us with this shared experience that we had. You know, some of us are, you know, still in touch. And, you know, I think we will be, because, you know, you go through things that nobody else has gone through, and you can talk to people about, you know, things that, you know, you can talk to and have people understand. But as far as who sees my writing and who, like, I'm try to go easy on my husband with the questions, like, what do you think about this? Where do you think we should bury this body? What do you think about, does this make sense? My children too, especially my daughter, I will bounce ideas. She's 21. She can read this kind of stuff. I'll bounce ideas off her. Like, what do you think, which do you think is better? The difference with this book is I think I bounced more ideas off writer friends. You know, this was the one where I was able to say, hey, person who actually writes the same kind of stuff that I do, do you think A or B is better? And that's the first time I've done that. So it was kind of almost joyful experience, finding that community and being able to connect to in a way. And you know, I just went to Thriller Fest, and it was so fun to spend a weekend with, you know, a whole group of people whose eyes don't glaze over when you're talking about your book for the 15th time. You know,
I know I wanted to go to Thriller Fest, and I was enrolled, and my husband suddenly had to have cervical spine surgery on May 16th, and he can't drive, and he's all right now, but he couldn't drive and he couldn't pick up anything. We have three dogs, you know, and so I wound up telling Kimberly I would just donate my membership this year, because, you know, I couldn't go off and leave him for several days. But I was sad, because you're right, it is wonderful to go and do that. The San Diego BoucherCon is a mystery gathering. Thriller Fest is more specifically targeted towards people who write thrillers, that it's also more of a professional gathering instead of a fan gathering, which BoucherCon and other conferences like Left Coast Crime, so forth, are. But anyway, it'll be great to go. We went to BachelorCon last year, and then since we were in St. Paul, and I had always wanted to go down the Mississippi as the only major river we haven't actually gone down, I couldn't resist leaving on Friday and taking a riverboat down to St. Louis, which was great. So I didn't spend the whole weekend in Minneapolis, but it was nice to see people excited about getting together again after, you know, both virtual ones and then weather wiped out one. I'm trying to remember, it's been an unlucky convention, you know, but it was nice to see it back on track. And we'll hope the hurricane season doesn't come blowing through San Diego.
Are you going to BachelorCon?
I am. Yes. Now I'm going. And I'm really looking forward to it since Thriller Fest didn't work out. And I've also signed up for the Nashville one, which will be at the same season next year. And that's another thing for those of you watching. If you have a chance, it's great to go to those conferences as a fan, because you get to interact with other fans who don't think you're weird being a fan. But you also get to go to different places, because that's part of the point. Thriller Fest is, the first one was here because I actually started Thriller Fest, and they had it here in Arizona in July. And I said to them, this is not a good idea to have a big conference in July. Yeah, it's just too hot and whatever. So anyway, they took it to New York, where it actually gathers, but the other conferences move around, and so you get a chance to explore different communities, different writer communities, different book selling communities. You know, it's all great. Now I've lost track of what it was. Oh, I know what I was gonna. I think I know what I was. Hold on, while the thought comes back to me.
I will say that was my last year's Thriller Fest. Was the first conference I'd ever been to of any kind ever.
Oh, was it? Yeah. So it really was a big experience for you.
It was an amazing experience. And now that I've gone to this Thriller Fest, it makes two. So BachelorCon will be three. I really was in a bubble. I was so excited about going to the one in 2020.
But yeah, well, it was nice to, you know, as you say, to get out again. So it'll come back to me what I was going to ask you about the writer's thing, but let's go back. And what were your first two books? Do you want to give us a little précis of the first two?
They were both standalones, as you've mentioned. No Bad Deed is about a Good Samaritan who sees a couple fighting alongside the road and stops to help. And then the attacker, you know, tells her, you know, let her die and I'll let you live. And she, of course, is not about to do that. And she intercedes, and the sirens chase the guy away, but he escapes with her van and her ID and everything. Mm-hmm. And so then her life starts to fall apart. And she's like, her husband goes missing, and she's wondering, is this connected? And Blood Will Tell is about, you know, it starts with, I love my first scenes. I love writing first scenes. I could write 100 first scenes. Why can we do that? Can we just write 100 first scenes? Frankie is stopped at a gas station. There's an Amber Alert. Her truck has been spotted at an abduction. And it's not the first time that she's been linked through her sister, her younger sister, who she feels very maternal because there's a big age difference, and she also helped raise her. And so she is, you know, 6 years or 5 years before, six friends went partying and the game got out of hand, and the only five returned. And so now there's another missing girl, and Izzy might be involved. So she's torn between protecting her sister and finding out the truth.
Got it. Now I've remembered what I was going to ask you, because you said other people who write stuff like me, or you probably said it more elegantly. What is it that you think you write when you say stuff like me or books like me? What does that mean to you?
Well, I would say in general, thrillers and suspense. I would say on a more granular level, I think I tend to write domestic thrillers where people are, you know, and they can be a little dark and pacey and twisty and that kind of thing. So, and also pretty much, well, I mean, the book I'm working on too fits this mold. So I maybe book five, I probably not, but actually definitely not. strong female characters. And when I say strong, I sometimes hesitate to use that word because, you know, what is strong, you know, and why should we have to be strong? You know, I mean, you know, we should be able to be flawed and complicated and weak sometimes, and we should be all of those things. So when I talk of strength, I talk of it as, you know, mental, emotional, you know, and some physical, if depending on the character. But the truth is that a botanist single mom is not going to solve the problem the same way as a pregnant assassin. I mean, just not. And so, you know, when I say strong, I maybe better word would be complicated.
Yeah, well, complicated works. Although I have to say that in this book, both the botanist,
yeah,
you know, cactus raising single mom and the pregnant assassin are both, I mean, it's a real duel between the two of them. So in their different way, they're equally strong. But I've had, I mean, I do this, you know, once or twice a day. I've had a lot of conversations with authors this spring, women authors, about a lot of books that are fueled by female rage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that that has become, I've been two or three, the female serial killer has emerged. And part of it seems to be rooted in female rage over, you know, one thing or another. Rin is not a serial killer. You know, she has things to be angry about, but she's a professional, you know, focused. She's not driven by, even though she's had difficult things in her past, you know, she's not out seeking revenge. I mean, you know, we're using that word a lot at the moment, revenge travel, you know, revenge shopping, whatever it might be, which I don't think is actually a good word, you know, to be using it. I think it's just a pent up, I don't think it's revenge in the sense you can't be angry at travel, which is an inchoate, you know, word. I think you can feel you were deprived of travel, or you know, got stifled or whatever it might be. But revenge to me always implies, you know, a target that can act, and, you know, travel can't do that. So, but I am seeing a lot of really angry women, for one reason or another, and they erupt in violence, and not necessarily professionally, you know, but more in an amateur way. You know, they sort of stumble into serial killing, you know, without, let's say there's no serial killer training school, for example. And, you know, male serial killers generally, although not always, have acted alone historically and in fiction, although there have been those pairs like Myra Hindley and whatever the name of her boyfriend was, you know, where you get a folie à deux thing where you have two people who separately might not have gone off the rails, but together, you know, the fusion of them does send them off into some kind of a spiral. Wasn't Robert Starkweather, I think, the whatever his name was, the Kansas guy? Robert or Charles? Maybe it's Charles. Anyway, so you get that. But, you know, a killer, I mean, somebody like Rin is really interesting in that, you know, she's not, it's not a folie à deux thing, you know, two people being crazy together. She's not, you know, striking blindly out of rage at random targets, for example. She's a real assassin. So why did you decide to make her that way? Was that necessary for the cat and mouse game that you created? She had to be focused.
You know, I really wanted to explore a character unlike a character that I had created before. And I like the freedom of Rin. And I think that's why I made her a pregnant assassin. The image, you know, I mentioned that the climax and the first scene kind of came fully formed in, not exactly how they ended up being, but pretty close. Rin's opening, when I thought of Rin, I thought of her first scene, that moment, not the whole scene, but that moment, that she is pregnant, and she's just newly pregnant, but she's starting to show the baby bump, and she is trying on a gun holster and trying to figure out, you know, hey, I've got to change things up because my body's changing. And I saw her at the rack when I saw the character. And so she just came to me like that. I liked the idea of, you know, with my characters are not like, I mean, they share bits of me. For instance, Cassie in my first book has real guilt over work-life balance. And I did too as a working mom. And then, you know, I do, you know, I was raised by a single mom. I was, you know, moving my daughter to college. I mean, there's like obviously parallels, but Ren was not like me. And it was fun because I got to say, you know, oh, Ren wouldn't do that. Oh yeah, she would do that. And, you know, which was different. You know, you have this certain expectations of your single mom botanist. You know, she's, you know, a woman of academia. She's a nurturer who's been caring for her daughter and raised her pretty much by herself for 18 years. And you have certain expectations, and she's not going to suddenly go and poison someone. I mean, she might, but it would be a harder sell, I think. Whereas Ren had such freedom. And that's why it was so fun to write, because whatever I could do anything. You know, within her character, you know, I she's pretty rigid actually, but I liked the freedom to be like, who knows how this will end up? We really don't. You know, and part of me was inspired by, of course, Killing Eve, who doesn't love that, and the books that inspired them. But at the same time, you know, that's a very different dynamic. You know, and I wanted it to be kind of like a domestic thriller, but she's, you know, she's worried her husband might be lying to her. He's hiding things from her. She's pregnant. It's affecting her body. She has to go to the bathroom all the time. You know, she's slower than she used to be. And oh yeah, she kills people. So I mean, it's kind of like how an assassin might also be married and raising a family. I mean, that idea was like really interesting to me. So,
well, I mean, I think a real question, certainly a question that occurred to me, is that if she's a professional assassin who has to be in tip-top physical shape, and given her background and so forth, she doesn't have to stay pregnant. I mean, why has she decided to keep the baby? I mean, right, you know, we're in the middle of all this abortion hot button stuff, but, you know, she would in today be able to, you know, safely have an abortion somewhere anyway. Why would she choose not to do that? Because a baby seems like the last thing that ought to be part of her, both her professional and her personal life.
I envision her, especially as the book starts, as being very much in love with her husband, attracted to her husband, and also really respectful and, you know, loving with her dad. And I feel like she loves the idea of family, and she doesn't see why she can't do both. She's like, at one point in the book, she's thinking, you know, this pregnancy thing is kind of rocks, because people never suspect a pregnant woman. And so she's suddenly thinking, maybe I should even take this further, like pretend to be pregnant when I'm not. So I think she doesn't see it as an either or. I think she just figures, like at one point, even Nolan says, you know, maybe I'll take up more of the jobs. And yeah, she's not having any of that. She's like, I can do both.
She can do both while she's pregnant, but you know, childcare is a whole nother issue. And this has come up over the years, even in, you know, the cozy crime field and so forth. I mean, I've been doing this for 33 years, so I've been able to trace these tropes for a really long time. And it was always a very critical issue, not so much about being pregnant, but about if you have a child dependent on you, how much risk can you afford to put yourself in? What effect will that be for the child? Who's going to raise this child if in the course of, you know, your work, you're going to get killed or going to get hurt? So, I mean, to do this, Rin must really have some vision of herself as invulnerable. It must not really occur to her that she could have this baby and then get killed on the job, and there would the child be. Yeah, I don't think she's doing long-range thinking, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I think she also, you know, we're talking to her, and I think she also feels as if she's doing the world a service, and there are sacrifices and if she has to sacrifice herself, and her father's retired, I think she thinks of that as a safety net. We don't want to go too deeply into the book itself, other than, you know, that she does at the beginning of the book, she does think she has a very strong support system. You know, it may be limited, but she does feel connected to her husband and connected to her father. And so I think there's a little bit of that. And there's also a little bit of the fact we kind of are our trauma, you know, and she has been raised this way where this is like, what else would she do? What other possible life does she have?
Yeah.
That being said, as a pregnancy does become real to her, more real to her, she does start to question what she's doing a little bit, you know? But I think you're right that she does feel somewhat invulnerable. I mean, she feels invulnerable in the way that she feels like she's doing something important. And I don't think, even though she sees death all the time, I don't think she sees vulnerability within herself.
Right. I don't either. She's
really good at what she does. I mean, I think she does say that, like at a few junctions, she talks about how it's an art, you know, as much as a science, because if she wasn't really good at what she did, she's approaching people double her size, and she has never been injured. You know, she feels vulnerable because she kind of has been.
And well, she reminds me of a teenager kind of in that respect. You know, I mean, some of the great war heroes like Audie Murphy and so forth, one reason they were fabulous war heroes is they were like teenagers and didn't occur to them that, you know, they could actually be shot and die or, yeah, you know, be shot and hurt. There's that whole teenage attitude. And, you know, I mean, I'm actually like Julia, we're talking about Rin almost all the time here, but I think Julia is, to me anyway, in many ways, the more interesting character, or at least as interesting character, because, you know, here she is, she's a mom and a professor and, you know, trying to navigate without a husband that she still feels like she ought to text and update about how their daughter's doing and so forth. And yet, you know, she has to find resources because, I mean, this does become a physical and very dangerous cat and mouse game. You know, it's not like she's out foxing her in the office playing, you know, Clue or something like that, you know. So I really think they're very well matched. And you did a great job with that, you know, that it's a real question which one of them is going to make it through and what's the goal of each one. Julius, I don't think really evolves. You know, her goal is pretty clear all the way through. So Rin's the character more on a journey. You know, and if part of the story is a quest, you know, then that's sort of where that works out.
Yeah, I think that with Rin also, you know, that was a pretty apt analogy as far as her being a teenager, you know, because they do have a sense of invulnerability. And she is a little bit socially and emotionally more stunted than Julia. Yeah. Julia has, you know, in some ways she's more protected than Julia. And so she does have a different way of looking at the world. Sometimes I think, what would it have been? What would the book have been if instead of pregnant, she had a toddler? I don't know. I mean, obviously it would be a different book. Obviously it would be a different book because she would have already gotten to a stage where she sees baby is more real now. But yeah, Julia, I loved writing Julia too. I mean, the thing about Julia is she is, you know, she has all the corny puns and she has this deep love for her daughter, and she's a little bit goofy in some ways, but she's also got a pretty dark past too. And the fact that she has to deal with her own trauma, it just, and how she does it, that's different, you know, how she reacts, that's a complete, you know, different tact than.
Absolutely. No, she's a survivor, and as a survivor, she's pretending. You know, we're having this conversation like these are real people that we, you know, we could have gone and had coffee with or something, you know. And that's a mark, I think, of, you know, successful characterization, is that the, you know, you can actually have a discussion about what it would be like. And, you know, it's interesting. Readers bring their own stuff, you know, to character and to story. And everybody reads a book differently. If there's one thing I have learned doing this for so long, and if you run a book club or stand at the counter, you know, checking people out or something, you recognize that authors often don't see it right away. And every person reads a book differently. So your job as an author, you know, once you publish the book and you put it out there, is done. But really, it's every reader that then takes your book and, you know, makes it whatever it turns out to be. So that's fascinating. But I usually ask if you're working on another book, but you've already mentioned that you're doing that, so we're safe there. Right. So that part's great. Let's call Jacob up and see if anybody has followed this discussion long enough to have a question. Now you're blinded by the sun. Sorry, sweetie.
It's okay. Hi, Heather. We had a few questions regarding... Okay, here's this one. How have you changed as a writer since your first book?
Well, I, you know, the first time I met my editor, I have a new editor for this third book. And the first time I met her, I said, you know, the first book, I found my voice. The second book, I found my process. And the third book, I found my joy. And I think that's kind of how I've changed. I think, you know, I mentioned, I wrote three and a quarter practice books before I wrote No Bad Deed. Mm-hmm. And so it was really about finding the confidence to write what I wanted to write in the voice I wanted to write, because a lot of the books I grew up writing were, you know, very male driven third person. There was a certain structure to them. And then I started reading more, you know, female protagonist driven fiction. And I was like, my book was from a male point of view, the one I was writing. And I was like, no, this is not the book I need to write the first. And then I wrote No Bad Deed. And then I actually changed her to a first person because I wanted to get close. I wanted to get intimate with her. I wanted to know her. And that just felt like a natural choice because my three practice books were all third person. So, you know, I did change like that way. And then now I'm back to third person with this book, but it also feels like a much closer third person than I wrote when I was younger, because I've now learned how to get close to my characters. In fact, it was funny, it's totally aside, but it'll be quick. When I was writing my first book, I'm not a natural, because I raised two kids, I'm not a natural foul mouth a person. If I hit my hand with a hammer, of course I'm going to swear, but it just wasn't something I did a lot when the kids were young, obviously. And then when I was writing Cassie, she swears, my first character. And I would come downstairs and I would just say something and I would just drop an F-bomb. And my daughter, who was a teenager at the time, was like, you were writing, weren't you? Because it does influence who, you know, your characters influence you. And so I was like, kind of, now I feel a little bit more assured in my approach. And I feel like I could try new things. And it's, it's fun. I mean, it's, I've kind of established the foundation. I feel like I know what I want to write. I know what kind of voice I have. And now I know I like short and pacey chapters. There are certain hallmarks that are things that I like to read that I now write. So, but now I can play with structure a little bit and point of view a little bit and have fun with it, I think.
Okay, great. When did you decide you wanted to be a writer?
When did I decide I wanted to be a professional writer? Or when did I decide? I got, when I was graduated high school, I got the best writer award for my high school class. I always wanted to be a writer. I always wrote, started with poetry. I got my first $3 check from a regional Kansas magazine when I was young. I don't remember, 10 maybe. And then I actually maybe younger, maybe 8. It was very young. And then I switched to darker fare when I at 11, I read my first Dean Koontz book. And I was like, oh yeah, let's go dark. Forget these happy feely poems. Let's do something dark. And that's like, I mean, when my grandfather passed away, they found his safe. One of the first, like my first book was called Rabbit's First Christmas. And then my second book was, when I was in middle school, was about a killer at a summer camp. So, you know, totally went a different direction. yeah. So I've always known, I didn't feel comfortable enough showing people my writing until after No Bad Deed. And like I said, it was my agent, my amazing agent, was the first person to read it. And, you know, I felt like I can trust people. And that was scary. That was so scary to say, here, read this book that I, here, stranger, read this book that I've poured my heart and soul into. And so once I took that step, it was like, no looking back though. It was like, I love this. I should have been doing this long before, but.
That's it.
I have to unmute myself because the dogs think it's dinner time. All of a sudden there was this barrage of barking out there. So I didn't want to spoil this by having them intrude on it. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for spending almost an hour with us. Before She Finds Me, wonderful book, you know, at any time, but since we're all looking now for summer reading and, you know, beach reading and all that good stuff, this would be an excellent choice for you. Fortunately, we have copies for sale at the Poison Pen. Amazing. So I will look forward to actually seeing you in person in California. And I will be coming to you from Dean Koontz because we're going to get together on my way over there. So, you know, if he's a hero of yours, I will.
Oh my gosh. Just tell him I love him. That's all. That's all you have to do. He was the first author I approached for a blurb.
Yeah.
And he didn't give it. He said it was too busy, but he gave me a handwritten letter about, you know, wishing me luck and everything. And I'm like,
He's a very kind man and would like to be supportive. He has a work-driven ethic that's hard to imagine. But he's very kind. We email back and forth. I email and he has someone who reads the emails and writes them out for him. And, you know, so it's an interesting experience, but it's been a real joy of the last maybe 10 years to spend time with him because, you know, when somebody is that seminal and that celebrated, it's pretty scary to sort of like handing over your book to your agent, yeah. You know, and I've observed, and I was guilty of it too. Most people, when they meet somebody like that, are sort of bereft of both speech and thought and say something like, I'm your biggest fan. Or, yeah, I mean, you know, we all say something completely stupid in moments like that. So I'm grateful that I've had a chance to actually learn to talk to her.
At 11, whispers changed my life. So
that, I will tell him.
Yeah, that is that, you know, that's the, his book made my career.
Wonderful. Well, I'm sure that will mean a lot to him to know that. And it's, So I say he's a remarkable person. Anyway, it's been a real pleasure. So thank you very much, Jacob. Thank you. We are definitely, you know, you almost look like, hilariously, you're wearing a hat because where the sun is hitting your head, it's all gone blonde. It's so interesting. Yeah. I see. So I think we're going to need to get you a black screen or something for he's got a west-facing window and it's just that wrong thing. The good news is that today's the 22nd and we're losing daylight every single day, which in Arizona is a joy. I have a friend from Alaska who spends part of the winter with us, and she always says on December 22nd, yes, we're getting daylight. You know, we're gaining daylight. So I always say to her on June 22nd, yes, we're losing daylight. Go for it. Right. So anyway, everybody, thanks for spending time with us. Enjoy your evening. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.